hi, everybody. Welcome to my reading room. And what I'm going to be looking at tonight is the subject of controlling your diet and how to stay well. Having spent several sessions proving to you that foods can be very bad, in fact, the title of my talk, the PowerPoint I go around with is Surprising Ways That Foods Can Really Hurt You. And some very good examples of that. So having convinced you of that, it would be a disservice not to also explain how you stay well. See, so far we've looked at ways to investigate this proposition, you know, that food might be making you ill. You try experimental omissions and experimental challenges, and hopefully the picture hasn't been too completely confusing and not left you floundering, that you've got some answers. You're better. So, is that the end of the story? Well, unfortunately it's not, because we're dealing with a property here that tends to keep raising its head. What I mean is by this, and I used to explain to patients in the office, is you have the tendency, you know, even though we found your allergies, you got rid of your arthritis, or you haven't had a migraine for 10 weeks, all that's wonderful, but you still, so you've not cured the allergy and you've not cured the tendency. What you may have done is simply cured the output symptom or cured the target organ problem, you know, that we explained all that. And it's a fact that if you do develop reactions, that you will always tend to develop reactions. It's not sure to happen to you, but it's a tendency that you've got to learn to live with. And there are certain catches that are there to trip up the unwary, most important of which is developing new reactions. It's very important you understand that these things don't stay static. There is a thing called a fixed allergy, which I explained. It's usually the severe one, you know, it's peanuts and the person can't breathe even. They swell up and it may even end up in an ER or dangerously ill. Those are fixed allergies. They're very rare. The most common by far is what we call a cyclical allergy, where it simply builds up. So if you've followed me and you're thinking logically, you'll understand the problem, which is that you get yourself onto a bunch of safe foods and eat those instead. But, you know, what's to stop you developing reactions to those, especially if you eat them heavily, because, as is sometimes the case, you feel that the choices are restricted. So you pick a few other new foods, a few new favorite foods, and then eat those to the point where you start reacting to those too. That can happen. So it's something that you've got to be aware of. So in the book, I made a whole point of really discussing this topic, which is what to do after the diagnostic and recovery period, how to stay well. If you followed the procedure as I've described and you became well, you identified foods that made you demonstrably ill, but the deterioration, let's say you deteriorate, doesn't last. If it's quite quick after that period, I would say likely you've made a mistake. Or not even a mistake, it can be impossibly difficult sometimes, but something has gone wrong, shall we say, in the testing and challenge process, that somehow something slipped through the net. Just get what I'm saying here. You know, you feel great on the diet, all the headaches are gone, you introduce all the foods and you identify a couple, stay off those, but somehow, you know, you get another headache a week later and that's a surprise, but you don't think that's fair, you think you've identified the culprits. The most likely reason for that scenario is that something got back in the diet that shouldn't have. It's a pain to follow, but being ill is a pain, so it shouldn't trouble you too much, so just go through the procedure again. And this time it'll be quicker because you already know maybe two or three foods that you shouldn't eat anyway. And so you can very quickly start going back to the challenge and reintroduction phase, often within as little as 5 days. You just go back on the diet. After 5 days, everything's cleared, unmasked. And of course, you wouldn't bother challenging the ones that you already know are bad. But you challenge again the ones that you thought seemed okay. But just take more care, eat more of it, take longer. You know, instead of doing one food a day, maybe eat it for 2 or 3 days just to be really sure. And generally speaking, you'll pick up what went wrong. There was something got back in there that shouldn't have. The biggest enemy, you see, is that if you stay off the food a while, then it tends to settle down. It's a dose-related thing. So if you don't have very much, you might think it was okay. You can tolerate a modest amount, but if you eat more than the modest amount, then you get a symptom. So those are the kind of things that you're looking for. Now, the other thing that often, well, this was the most common explanation for deterioration. Patients at the office, okay, they'd be great, and before their follow-up visit, they would call in and say, oh, I feel bad again. And I always ask the same question, are you staying strictly off the identified foods, the bad foods? And I would say 9 times out of 10, the person would say, well, no. And that's the answer. I mean, the answer is stay off the food. If you stay off the food, then you won't deteriorate. Okay, so you've got two scenarios there to compare. One is where something got back in that shouldn't have, and it's causing you a problem, and you didn't know about it, but you can figure it out. The other one is something's got back in, it's causing you a problem, but you'll know perfectly well what it is, and you shouldn't be eating it. In the second scenario, really, it actually just boils down to willpower or common sense, or as I've said in the book, whichever the two you're most short of. I know it can be difficult, but there isn't any way around this argument. There's no way of saying, you know, oh, well, you know, don't worry, do this and this. There isn't any way around it. You know, you stay off the food, you feel well, or forget it, because it's not going to work if you eat a food that's a poison. In the long term, you may be able to eat the food, and that's what this call is about. I'll come to that. But in the short term, you can't. It's just too hostile for you, and it won't do any good if you just go back to the food. I used the image before of like a fire that, you know, you can dampen this fire down to just glowing embers, which means no real problem and no real symptoms. But if you throw fuel on the fire, it will blaze up again. That's like eating the food again. It just doesn't make any sense, and it will flare up very quickly. And I'm surprised at the number of times, you know, that people would call me and say, you know, it's come back, what's the problem? And they're eating the food. I say, well, duh, you know, if you've identified it as a bad food, you have to stay off it. But there's a third scenario here, which also you need to understand, which is that the person, you know, the foods were good, the identified foods are good, the person is behaving and following the diet, but nevertheless deteriorates. That's not common, but it happens. I would say, depending on the severity of the, you know, if you take the average person, it's probably less than 1 in 20. But if you take very sick people, and I dealt with some extremely sick people in my time who could hardly walk, some of them were brought to the office on stretchers. We got it figured out in the end. But, you know, they were really bad, really sick and really poisoned, not just food. These would be chemically sensitive people as well, often electrically sensitive people, just in a whole overload situation. And until we get the overload reduced for long enough for recovery to take place, then the person is always very vulnerable. And what's happening here is that the person very quickly develops new reactions. They're relying on the safe foods, and the tolerance of the safe food breaks down, and so the problems start all over again. Now, if you've been a person, I hope you're following me with the program, and if you're a sufferer yourself, I hope you've done well. If it's worked for you, that's great. What you need to look at then, if things deteriorate, is what of these scenarios are you facing? Because if it's the third one, there is an answer, you see. I'll go into it in a minute. But be very clear, you know, if it happens very quickly, it probably means you made a mistake. If you already you know you're eating something you shouldn't, there isn't any other answer than just behave yourself and be sensible. But for those unlucky people who deteriorate, the answer is to space out your contact with the food. We call this a rotation diet. In fact, it's called a rotary diversified diet. It rotates, meaning things only come up periodically, and it's diversified, meaning there's a real effort to make sure that no one food or no one family of foods comes up too often. Now, this can be quite difficult and can be quite demanding, but the good news part is that it isn't usually, you know, it's not for life, that a person may have to do it for a few years, maybe even, you know, just a couple of years, but it's not for life. You can eventually dig your way out of the mess, so do bear that in mind. But if you're facing this tendency to deteriorate and tendency to develop new reactions, you do what Herbert Rinkel, I've already mentioned him, he's the man that discovered the hidden allergy effect. He was one of the real founders of the clinical ecology and food allergy movement, really. That was his term, a rotary diversified diet. Now, don't confuse that with a popular rotation diet. It was published in the 1980s. It's more or less gone, you know, disappeared below the radar, but you might come across it. It's by Martin Katan, K-A-T-A-H-N. It didn't show really very much of the understanding that I'm talking about here. It wasn't based on this approach at all. It was based on another idea, and it would get you confused. It was not a proper rotation diet in the sense that I mean it here. Okay, now, what do we mean by a rotation diet? The principle isn't hard to understand. You make sure that each individual food only comes up, it's not eaten at random, but comes up to a precise timetable. And typically that will be 4 or 5 days. If the person is very sick, it might only be once a week, but that's unusual. More typically 4 or 5 days. And if you've followed me on the other series, you'll know why. That's because that's how long it takes to clear your bowel. And we're concerned that you should clear the food before you eat the next dose. That way you'll probably be able to tolerate it and you won't get into the hidden allergy effect. So on this kind of diet, there are no daily foods, okay? You don't have a cup of coffee every day. You just don't. Too bad. You can try substitute drinks, you know, things made with chicory. You've got herb teas. There are various things that you can rotate, but there are no daily foods. But you also have to pay attention to something called food families. And if you've not met that concept, I better introduce it now. A food family is a group of related similar botanical foods. And most of them are pretty obvious. For example, everyone would know that cabbage and cauliflower and broccoli and kale, they're all in the same family. It's obvious. But, for example, mustard, turnip, rutabaga, also in the same group. That includes beet greens and bok choy, Chinese cabbage, collard greens, kohlrabi and radish. Lots and lots of foods in that family that you might not recognize or might not even be familiar with and certainly wouldn't necessarily know belong to that family. It's a big family. It's a family of foods called the brassicas. They used to be known as the crucifers. And the mustard plant alone, there are actually over 3,000 species of mustard plant. And we eat quite a lot of those. And surprisingly, rapeseed or rapeseed oil and canola are very important members of this very large family of foods. So why am I telling you this? Well, the point is to try and make sure that the individual food families don't come up too often either. Thinking this through, it would not be logical to be eating Brussels sprouts on a Monday and then cabbage on a Tuesday and broccoli on a Wednesday. You'll see the problem with that straight away. That's not really rotating and spacing things quite enough. It can be very difficult to space everything 4 days, so if the patient is reasonably well, and this is only a minor problem, I would generally find it was okay to allow them to have the food family every 2 days. The actual food should occur only once every 4 days, but the food family could be every 2 days. So you could, for example, you could tolerate some grains, wheat on a Monday, corn on the Wednesday. You could be back to wheat again on the Friday, although that would be pretty repetitive. There's much more variety can be got from the grains than that. There are all the grains. Remember barley and rye and triticale and millet and so on, rice. So, you make an effort to vary these things, and it has to be a clear effort because it's not our natural habit. One is we do eat foods, you know, visible foods that are repetitive. Most people eat bread or some form of wheat every day. You know, they have pizza and pasta and all those things. One second, my wife has just popped in with some kind of signal. Excuse me, woman. On the line? Okay. Well, I'm not hearing what you guys are hearing, but she just said there was a huge bang online, so I don't know what that was. And I really apologize if it disturbed anybody. Anyway, I'm still here, and I hope you can hear me. I presume it wasn't a technical problem. Well, I've still got dozens on the webcast, so I presume they'd all have logged off if there was a problem. So I'm sorry for that interruption. I don't know what it means, but I'll edit it out on the replay broadcast that we'll have eventually. So not a big deal, in other words. Okay, so back to the rotation diet principle. And I want to say one of the things that I observed that came to me, as it were, an aha moment back in the 80s, was that really nature used to do this for us years ago. Okay, well, okay. She's saying the bang happened again. So I honestly don't know what this is. I can't turn on my webcast feedback, otherwise we'll end up with an echo at my end. I can only apologize once again and assume it's something to do with the atmosphere, the cosmos, possibly the technicalities at the service provider, but it's not on my phone because I didn't hear anything. I didn't hear anything at all. It sounds fine to me. In fact, let me open up the lines 1 second. If there's anybody on, how do I do that just quickly? Oh, yeah. Right, anyone on the phone call, can you report back to me? Anyone heard a bang, or are we okay on the phone?
No bang.
No bang.
No, okay. All right, folks, sorry to disturb you. We'll edit all this. No. And my wife, I promise you, she's not been on the gin or anything like that. it's just some technical mystery thing. And I mean, computers, some days, and I loathe them. I wish they'd never been invented. But they're such magic, aren't they? I mean, we couldn't live without them, seriously. It's wonderful to be connected with people all over the world. Still, you know, there are days when I don't think it makes it worthwhile. Anyway, big breath, back to what we're saying. This is the end of the bit that I'm editing out. Back to, I was saying, explaining to you here that I noticed this back in the 80s, this principle that nature actually used to rotate our foods for us. If you think about how it worked, you know, you'd have the spring, the crops would come in spring, you'd get the cereals and grains come in summer, and then in the fall, you'd get fruit. The fruit would last, you know, if you stored it really carefully, would last through most of the winter, but then it was gone till the following fall. If you took something like a tomato, see how long I've been living in America now, I say tomato. They used to come on stream around about Easter. If you had a good greenhouse and you were in a southern climate, you could maybe get them a little bit sooner. But they were all gone early September, the time of the first frost. Now we can have tomato every single day of our lives from somewhere in the world. This is not good. This violates nature's principle. Basically, she considers that we're hunter-gatherers. She doesn't think we're vegetarians, and she doesn't think that we're fans of McDonald's or anything like that. She thinks, certainly has no idea that we're sat behind desks working computers and driving cars. She thinks that we're cavemen wandering through the forest and, gathering fruits and nuts and roots, drinking water and occasionally catch an animal and a fish and so on. The only exceptional treats would be honey if we could endure the stings. And I actually I think I pointed out before the humor of alcohol in this, because fruit left on the ground will rot and turn to alcohol. And there are some very funny videos of elephants getting seriously drunk on fruit. If you go to YouTube and type in drunken elephants, you'll have 4 or 5 minutes of hilarious fun seeing completely ratty elephants staggering against trees. And of course the big things often knock the tree over when they're drunk and stagger. So you might just allow that as a possible Stone Age food. But really everything else is artificial. But you see how that would rotate things. You know, you're walking along, you've got a certain kind of shrub, but then, you know, you're over the next mountain into the next valley. A completely different bunch of foods. So that's really how we're built. And if we don't live that way, we may inherit a problem. Some of us have, you know, constitutions like iron and don't seem to suffer. But most people do if you ask the right questions. You know, even I met people over the years who are very arrogant and, you know, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm fit as a butcher's dog. I eat what I like. But, you know, I know some of these people in later years, the trouble will catch up with them. And also some of them then and there, if you actually question them carefully, they do have problems. But because they can still, you know, jog a couple of miles and still work out at the gym, they don't consider themselves sick, or they think, well, yes, I have headaches, but everybody has headaches. That's normal. And, of course, it's not normal. You know, I don't get a headache from one decade to the next, and I know a lot of people don't. So a lot of people assume that what they've got is normal, and it may not be so. So when you start asking the right questions, these kind of things are very common. So we generally don't abide by nature's guidelines, and we pay for it. It's as simple as that. Now, remember what I told you about farmer foods being different from caveman foods. We've only been farmers for about 10,000 years. That's really nothing in terms of evolution. So these foods are the ones, tend to be the ones that we tolerate the least well. Cereal foods or grain crops and dairy products, eggs and those kind of, then the weird things like sugar and tea and coffee, all the modern things. We're just too repetitive, basically, and you've got to get out of that habit. Now, I'm a great pragmatist. You know, if you're okay, you just knock off the coffee, say, and all your symptoms go, you still want bread every day, you still want to drink tea every day, and you can get away with it, that's fine. I'm just simply warning you of the principles, and if trouble creeps up on you, then you've got to be aware of what you're up against. I liken this to the rules of a game. You know, it's a game. If you don't know the rules, you can't win. If you know the rules, there's a good chance you can win. Because remember, the allergy tendency won't go away. The allergy might, their symptoms certainly should if you follow what I'm telling you, but the allergy tendency won't go away. So you need to know what are the rules that apply to the allergy tendency. And repetitiveness and quantitative measures of eating are the number one things that I found. The number, in fact, the most important question I ever asked a patient who walked in the door was, what foods do you eat every single day? Never miss. And generally, the trouble was on that list. A secondary list was, what do you eat twice a week? And if it wasn't on that list, then it didn't happen. Because if a person doesn't eat it often enough to become a mast allergy, the person already knows it's a problem. You know, they already know, every time I eat strawberries, I eat like crazy. So they stop eating strawberries. To be hidden and to become the kind of problem that we're talking about here, the thing has to be done repetitively enough that you're never really clear of it, as I said. Okay. Now, remember that this is generally, these are for more sensitive people. The rotation diet wouldn't normally apply. Just think of it as a principle. Just please, you know, bear in mind, if you're having wheat every day, day by day by day, just think to yourself, once in a while, maybe I should give wheat a rest for a couple of days. I assure you, you'll be a lot better for it. But the people who have to go on a rotation diet are those people that can't stay well without it. There are a lot of details in the book, and I won't delay the general discussion just for the sort of minute details of what you want. But let me just say, in passing, that even the people who are sensitive and have gone on a rotation diet, even then might start developing reactions to new foods. It can become very difficult and need a rotation diet of, say, one food, one meal, one time a week. Pretty rare. You would generally be in the care of somebody like me anyway, but I can tell you the key to that, the answer, the way out of the trap, is other approaches. Remember, we're still just talking about overload. Allergy is just a broad concept. It's really about overload. You can eat tons of allergy stuff if you're not overloaded, but if you're overloaded in other ways, something will happen. You will get symptoms, and the overload that you might look at is things like stress, fatigue, chemical overload, sometimes electromagnetic radiation overload. If you were on last week's teleseminar midweek with John Living, you remember we had a wonderful teleseminar about the effects of earth radiation creating problems for people who are sensitive, that it can add sufficient biological stress that illness appears and things start going wrong for all kinds of reasons. Okay, so that's rotation dieting. I want to introduce it, but it's a study in itself, really. Oh, by the way, when I went to Japan, in the Far East, this was back in the 80s when, you know, I was being called over there. My work was very current at the time and very new. But I came across some Chinese doctors that told me that rotation dieting was very common in China. The history of it goes back thousands of years. And I thought that was another typical story where the Chinese had, you know, quite a lot of wisdom. They got there first and seemed to understand the problems or situations that we're dealing with. I found it very interesting, and also, you know, just was simply interesting that it had never penetrated to the West, even though the Chinese were writing about it. I can't read Chinese, but, you know, it was all explained to me by these doctor colleagues who were very good, very, very receptive. Okay, so let's move on to other principles of staying well. Remember, that's tonight's theme. One of the common questions for a person who's gone through the program, feels great, knows they shouldn't touch dairy produce, say, is, what do I do when I eat out? Can I eat out? Well, the answer is yes, you can. You just have to be careful. And I can tell you that these days it's a lot easier than it was 20 or 30 years ago when we were first doing this. There was very little understanding in restaurants and eating houses or shops where you buy food. Now at least the issue is aired, even if people don't quite go with you or don't quite believe it. But most decent restaurants will help you. You just have to be careful of you occasionally run into a sort of cocksure type of character that says, oh, yeah, yes, and promises you things, but they don't take you seriously and cheat you in the sense that they say, oh, no, there's no cornstarch in this, but there actually is. Perhaps they're impatient with you or irritated or whatever their reasons, but they're not honest, or maybe they're just making a mistake. But that you've got to be careful and on your guard against that. That's one of your main problems. But if you stick with things that are hard to mess up, for example, it's hard to mess up a salad. You don't want the Caesar dressing and the vinaigrette necessarily. But you can look at the salad and see what it's made of. So it's generally better to eat whole foods. And you'd be better to have a slice of salmon, you know, say grilled salmon, where you can see exactly what you're getting. You can flavor it with salt and pepper and some herbs. Just skip the sauces. You know, when they start making fancy sauces, usually that means dairy, usually it means some kind of farina, whether it's wheat or corn flour, and that's where the risks start. So you can eat out if you're going to eat plainly, and with a little care, you'll soon get the hang of it, and also learning places near you that are cooperative, they tend to be places you go back to because you know you're going to get what you want. And it's really just like developing new habits, I suppose, basically. But sometimes there's a situation where, you know, say there's a big party or some big deal going on. It's an anniversary. Somebody doesn't want to get left out. And there, what we used to do, we discovered that there's a drug compound called sodium chromoglycate, which actually blocks allergic reactions of the histamine type. People with asthma use it. It's quite important to them. But there was great hope. Pfizer produced the drug. There was great hope that it would be good for food allergies, and they'd make a killing with that. It was sold as Nalchrom in Europe. I think it's Gastrochrom here, the same thing. And it works in the same way by blocking the breakdown of cells that release histamine. But unfortunately, it doesn't really work for food. Most of our immune system is in the lining of the gut, and that's the one that deals with food. And it doesn't seem to follow quite the right rules, unfortunately. So what happens if you take it by the third or fourth or certainly the fifth day? It stops working. It becomes worthless. It doesn't protect you. So that kind of marginalized that drug, and I'm glad in a way, because it makes people think and be intelligent about what they're doing instead of just popping a pill and then eating and drinking like idiots. But you can use this stuff, and generally you'll get a good reception if you ask a licensed physician to prescribe this for you, because it's considered an ethical drug. It isn't weird or strange. They're familiar with it, and they're generally happy to prescribe you some capsules, which you take carefully and selectively to a plan. You do not try and use them every day. As I said, it just won't work. But you can use them for a sort of anniversary or birthday or a special bash. Or sometimes patients would use it for a holiday. You know, they just got tired of all the allergy thing. More often their spouse got tired. You know, if you've been sick and you suddenly feel well, it's going to be a long time before you feel tired of that and want to go back to feeling sick. But often the spouses, who don't understand, they find it quite vexing that their partner won't eat this and won't eat that. Well, once in a while you can go out and have a nice dinner, a romantic candlelight dinner with your spouse or your lover, and just take some of this sodium chromoglycate first. It comes in 200 milligram capsules, and you typically take that four times a day. You don't want to do that, but have a couple before you go and a couple when you come back. Generally speaking, you can get away with murder. Obviously, if you've got an extreme allergy, like the peanut allergy, I do not rely on that to protect you. That it would be silly to take something like that. But, you know, if you've got a cyclical allergy to dairy, say, where it's one of those, you know, the more you eat, the worse you get, you can generally protect yourself enough to get by with the food. So that's another tip for you. You can be careful, or once in a while you can just let your hair down and say, to hell with it, and do whatever you want. And it can be very refreshing psychologically. I do know, working with patients over 30-odd years, that it can get very oppressive at times. You know, nobody likes to feel sick, and even though, you know, having a milk allergy and a wheat allergy and knowing if you stay off that means your arthritis is good and you can walk about freely, it still can be tiresome and oppressive at times. It gets on your nerves, you know, and it's nice to have a little break. There is always this problem. I should perhaps speak to it at this point. You know, this problem of getting obsessive and psychologically bogged down with a food allergy. People often get to the point of fear where they won't do things, they're afraid, and it becomes a problem to themselves as well as to other people around them. I can only encourage you to try and stay on top of it, try and stay, you know, broadly extrovert with this, and treat it as lightly as you can, consistent with staying healthy. Try to avoid becoming the obsessive compulsive type. It's a bad move. Keeping a food diary is good through the investigative period, but I would encourage you to put it away at this stage. Otherwise, you do run the risk of becoming, you know, completely obsessive in your eating. And, you know, eating itself is not a medicine or a science. Eating is just a way of nourishment to stay alive. One of the things that I do teach people makes it easier is to forget about food for pleasure. Just forget it. You know, at this stage, when working through this part, you concentrate on food for health. Food as a pleasure thing tends to make you a bit compulsive about eating the things you shouldn't, or impulsive, I should say. It's not quite the same as compulsive. You know, if you start dreaming up wonderful Provençal dishes, you know, with escargot, and you think of just, oh, I know just the wine that will go with this, and then a wine for dessert and a sweet one. You know, you hear people talk like this, but unfortunately, if you get this mentality, it works very hard against you and makes things tough. So for the short range, at least, it's better to get to the stage where you think, I couldn't care less what I eat. I'll just have some warmed over leftovers from yesterday. Boring, but at least it's the calories. At least I won't starve. And although it sounds unpleasant, I promise you it makes life easier. And it's one thing I teach, actually. Try and get yourself to the point where you're bored with food rather than relishing it. Okay, now I want to say a word about alcoholic drinks. There's a trap to alcohol. Alcohol has all sorts of things attached to its reputation. You know, it kills you, you die young, it extends your life, it protects you from heart disease, you know, all these stories. And I'm not going into the specifics, but what I need to tell you, from our point of view, we're talking food intolerance and food allergy, is that alcohol has a very precise story, which is it's the ingredients, it's not the alcohol. So, for example, to make a beer, a typical European beer, you'd need hops. Well, certainly the British make it with hops. Some kind of cereal or grain, sugar to ferment, and a yeast, of course, to do that. These are all food ingredients that turn out the alcoholic drink. Wine is better because it's typically just grapes and yeast, and it's not even artificial yeast. It's yeast that naturally occurs with the grapes in the wild. So, you know, if you're drinking wine, then you're only drinking grape and yeast, but beer is several ingredients, as I've just explained. Whiskey is often made from, it's supposed to be made with malt, which means malted barley, but these days it's often just malted wheat or malted anything, depends what the market will bear. And then foods that were traditionally, things like vodka, for example, which traditionally were made from fermented potato and still is in, you know, parts of what used to be the USSR. But what's sold in the West in trendy shishi bars, you know, Absolut and Stanislaw and those different kind of vodkas, those are usually made from wheat and corn anyway. What's the significance of that? Well, the significance is if you're allergic to the food, you're going to react very strongly to the alcohol drink. Theron Randolph, the great granddaddy in this field, he used to describe alcoholic drinks as jet-propelled food allergy. And I think that was a pretty good description of it, really. Whatever reacted on you in the fresh food form would react on you twice or 10 times as badly if it was accompanied with alcohol or an ingredient of alcohol. So beware. Having said that, there is a good hitting list, which is fairly consistent. And if you're out for a special meal and you'd like to consider a drink, and you're not sure, that the safest to try is dry champagne or sparkling wine, dry white wine. So, you know, white wine with or without the bubbles is the best bet. Red wine, not so good. And the reason is that there's a lot of histamine in red wine. Histamine is one of the main allergy activation compounds. It's the one that gives you headaches, makes you feel itchy and hot, flushed, can produce skin rashes. It's the last thing you need if you've got any kind of allergic tendency. So red wine, not so good. White wine is good. So after white wine, I would put spirits. A distilled spirit has very little of the original food ingredient in it. The downside is it's quite strong. You know, it can be 40 or 50% proof. That's not so good. That's too much alcohol if you drink more than the minimum. But there are choices you can make. Like if you can get proper tequila, for example, made from proper cactus, you're okay. Added to or mixed with or sweetened with proper natural raw fruit juices and equivalents, you can often come up with something that will work for you. I mean, you know, in the end, it may be just easier not to bother, and I know a lot of people choose that route. But some people get depressed by all this, and they want to know, surely, you know, I can have something. Well, the answer is you can if you're careful and if you understand the rules, like I'm saying. The exact details and the table of ingredients I've given in the book anyway, so you'd have to look up your favorite drink and see whether it's one that's consistent with, you know, the foods that you know you can tolerate. Now, while we're talking about alcohol, it's probably a good minute to relate to these food problems. Because I found, in the 80s, one of the interesting discoveries I found was that people very often reacted to the alcoholic drink because of the food ingredient that was in it, and that's what they were addicted to. I found this out because I took a of alcoholics and actually gave them shots of just pure alcohol, and nothing happened. They would still have the shakes or still feel the withdrawal symptoms. But if you gave them a shot of the, you know, let's say the person was a whiskey addict. They always like whiskey. I know that's wheat. A very good test for wheat allergies. Eat no wheat for 5 days. Have a double scotch. If you're addicted to whiskey, you will get a significantly severe reaction. I've forgotten to disable call waiting, so I'm sure you can beeping. Let me wait until it goes away. I even know who it is, but I'm answering. Again, I'll edit that bit out. Okay, forgotten what I was saying now. I was saying if you give the person the alcohol shot, it doesn't relieve it. But if you give them the food shot, it does. All the alcohol with symptoms go away. So that's definitely what the person is addicted to. And they've learned over the years that alcohol is the way to get a fast fix. And you can relate this to late afternoon. A lot of people at that time get low blood sugar, so they take an alcoholic drink because it's a fast solution to hyperglycemia. And they're also starting to get withdrawal symptoms. One of the longest gaps in our day is after lunch and before the evening meal. It may run on to as much as 5 or 6 hours. So a person starts to get withdrawal symptoms, so they know when happy hour comes around, that's the time when they need a fix, and they've learned, or their bodies conditioned them to have a fix of a drink that will fix the food craving. So, you know, wheaty people would tend to go and have a scotch. Corn would be the gin people, although a lot of gin also is made from wheat these days. You've got to know your drink and know what you're up against, really. But anyway, I just wanted you to know that, and I wanted you to find that interesting. If you know somebody who's an alcoholic, you can inform them through this book that there's a whole different approach to their disease that they may never have understood. If you identify the food culprit, eliminate the food culprit, then it becomes extremely easy to get off the food, but surprisingly easy to get off the food. It's completely different. Patients just expect you to say, stop drinking, and it's just a question of willpower. It's actually not a question of willpower if you know what you're up against. So there you are, fascinating bit of news. Now, other specific conditions we need to talk about. There are conditions that people suffer from that can cause problems with all this approach. For example, schizophrenia, because a person can become extremely disoriented if they do a food challenge test. Diabetics can have problems because, you know, a lot of the allergic-type foods are starchy carbohydrate foods, and so just suddenly dropping those out of the diet might mean they're overdosing on insulin, and, you know, they literally pass out on their insulin shot. Worth working through the program because I got lots of patients off their insulin, and almost all non-insulin diabetics can get off their drugs and be quite well self-controlled and self-managed by just eating the right things. There's always the question of drugs and medication when we're talking about programs like this. People may approach the program on drugs, and I'm talking about medical drugs. Although I should say also that street drugs are relevant. Perhaps I ought to say this here at this moment in case I forget. But over the years, I've met a lot of people severely allergic to some of the psychotropic drugs. The worst was marijuana, I found. People would often get wildly overreact. You know, it was nothing to do with the sort of friendly high that the hippies are after. They would go literally psychotic. And I trace this to actual allergic reactions to the marijuana, not the ordinary pharmacological thing. So that's an extra element in there that could really confuse things. But I was really more typically meaning to talk about medication. Usually you won't get much cooperation from your physician if you say, I want to take this route and not have drugs. They will look at you as either crazy or truculent or difficult, rebellious, and probably won't want to deal with you. But sometimes you have to keep contact with the doctor because you may be on some kind of medication that you've no choice on. For example, thyroid replacement medication. Digoxin type compounds for the heart and so on. There are certain liabilities to these, though, that you might bump into. The simplest of all being the ingredients of the tablet, not the drug, but the tablet ingredients. And typically, a tablet with, let's say, an antibiotic tablet would have the antibiotic in, but typically as many as 20 or 30 other ingredients that potentially the person could be reacting to. Certainly it's in the book, but I think I mentioned in one of the earlier reading room sessions a lady who was allergic to corn. She picked up her bad headaches licking the office mail, the envelopes. The gum starch on the envelope is corn. So if you've got a corn allergy, and in her case it was giving her bad migraines. But the irony was she was popping aspirin or paracetamol light pills, which are also cornstarch. That's how the pills are compacted together. So you can see the possible problems here. You know, you might have difficulties due not to the drug substance, but just to the way it's presented. This is particularly important in the case of kids, youngsters who are maybe having upper respiratory tract infections, sore throats, earaches, and so on. The question of whether to give an antibiotic. Well, an earache, for example, can be extremely unpleasant. There's certainly a reasonable question. I wouldn't say never, never. A reasonable question. Should you give this child an antibiotic? And it may produce very rapid relief. But this habit of presenting it in gooky, yucky, sticky, sugary, pink filth that has nothing to do with the drug, that is usually the problem. And I can't tell you how many people, youngsters that came to me who were diagnosed as penicillin allergic. And they weren't. They got the rash or the spots or the unpleasant reaction to the pink junk, not the actual antibiotic itself. And that's a shame because it means they were labeled as allergic and lost the value of what's really a very powerful but basically pretty safe antibiotic. I'm talking about plain penicillin. The broad spectrum type, of course, can cause all sorts of havoc in your bowel. So there we are. So that's just a word about drugs. Might be worth saying a little bit about steroids. That's something that people with allergies often find themselves on. And it's a difficult position here. You could say categorically we don't want anybody to take steroids, but some people do and find they get immense relief. Their life is misery without. And so they become conditioned to these things. And then it's very difficult to get rid of them, even if you go and see a completely enlightened doctor that would love to help you off these things completely. It's not always plain sailing, and there are only two ways to approach it, really. The one is the cold, what you might call it, the cold turkey approach. You just stop, and you suffer for however long it takes to calm down again. Because, you see, when you stop a steroid, you get what we call a rebound effect. It doesn't go back to how it was. It goes back to much worse than ever. It's like lifting the lid off something, you know, a pressurized pot. You lift the lid off, and whoosh, out comes all the steam. It's the same with the symptoms. It's like you're holding the lid on and then all of a sudden the symptoms come at you in a rush. So that's one approach. The other one is the very, very gentle tail off, where you just reduce it by a little each time. The second one is most important if the person has a potentially dangerous condition like asthma. Asthma, you must not underestimate. It's a very, very dangerous condition. A lot of people die of asthma. One of the sad things about modern medical science is that for the last 40-odd years, asthma-related deaths have continued on the rise despite all drugs and medication, and it's an unending rising graph. The reason being, of course, that doctors aren't looking for the causes. They're just looking for remedies and answers, and they tried this drug and that drug and the other drug. And they're not really looking for why the person is going to spasm in their lung tubes. And the most common reason is allergy. The most common reason by far is a food allergy. Doctors tend to think of dust. You know, maybe it could be cat fur, maybe it's house dust mite. I would say almost 9 times out of 10 it's something the person is eating, and if they stop eating it, their asthma improves dramatically. But since they're not looking in the right direction, people are still dying, which is very sad. Okay, so we'll move on now to talk. Remember that our theme is staying well. So one of the things that you need to consider is substitutes for whatever the problem is. When I started doing this in the late 70s, it was pretty grim. There weren't any. You just gave up. If you had a milk allergy, you could maybe get goat's milk. But there weren't any of the fancy alternatives that we know now and that are so familiar. Dairy or milk is one of those foods that I think, well, why do you need a substitute? You know, everyone's in the habit of having white, schlocky stuff from a glass several times a day or have it with your cereal. But why? You know, it's a habit that's not that difficult to break. A habit that doesn't really seem to make sense. You know, we all say that only cows should have cow's milk. It's nothing to do with humans. Once we're weaned, it's not really a natural food at all. But there are substitutes now, and there's many things that you can take. I'm not going to turn this into a catalogue of substitutes, except to say, you know, that you need to familiarize yourself with them. There are so many. For example, the commonest group of foods are the grass family, and there are alternatives for that now. You can get flours made with almost anything. If you don't have my wheat-free chocolate cake recipe, just email me and I'll send it to you. It's a chocolate cake that you can make literally without any wheat in it whatsoever. The flour, or the equivalent of the flour, as we say, or farina, as you call it in America. The farina equivalent is actually powdered almonds. You just put almonds in the blender until they turn into a fine dust, and you use that as the exact equivalent of flour. Very delicious. If you're allergic to eggs, you can't have it, because there's eggs in the recipe. But you see what I'm saying, anyway. So there are many possible alternatives, even as extreme as nuts. But then things like that are raised for the purpose of making flours, tapioca, sago, garbanzo bean, or chickpea for the English and European folk, all of these make perfectly good flours. In fact, gram flour, G-R-A-M. That's not Graham's flour. I know I got this from my editor for the book. She's an American. And she wrote it wrongly in all the chapters. She thought I meant Graham's flour, Graham's cookies, I think, is it? Anyway, it's not. It's gram, G-A-R-M. Gram flour is made from chickpea or garbanzo bean. It sticks quite well. In fact, I've seen waffles made without any milk or any egg, just using a substitute flour, soya milk, and some gram flour as a sticky substitute for the egg. So if you can make waffles, you can make just about anything, I think. Okay, so that's my point there. Now, what about sweeteners? People often ask me about that. You know, what if I shouldn't be using sugar, what should I do? Well, the first part of the answer is that you shouldn't need to sweeten things on a Stone Age diet. You know, when you're doing the exclusion diet, for example, there's nothing there that really needs sweetening. You know, you've got meat and fish and fruit and vegetables. If you think about it, those don't need sweetening. It's only when you get into artificial things that you need any kind of sweeteners at all. So really, I would encourage a person always just to give up the idea of sugar and sweeteners insofar as is possible. And after you've been off sweet things a while, you find that ordinary foods begin to taste sweet and your palate will change. I think that's the important thing. Try and change your palate. But if you can't, there are certain substitutes. The important things to stay off are real sugar, especially what's called invert sugar or sucrose. That's the white sugar that's so typical. Those are very high-impact stress foods. Do you remember a book by Professor Yudkin, published in the 80s, Pure, White, and Deadly? He lost his professorship for publishing that book due to the wicked machinations of the sugar industry. He lost his job. But still, he was very correct. You know, that's sugar is pure, white, and deadly, and this myth of it's pure is the very thing that makes it dangerous. So avoid that, whatever you do. And that really means alternative, or not alternative, but it really means fancy sugars. You've got things like Demerara sugar and Muscovado sugar. These are quite delicious tasting. They look dark brown, and there are certainly a few nutrients in them, you know, a few minerals, bits of iron. But really, the trade-offs are just not worth the risk, and it's best to avoid those altogether. So what about honey, for example? Well, a lot of people get dewy-eyed about honey. You know, it comes, I suppose, from reading Winnie the Pooh books like that. But it certainly doesn't come from reading science papers. Let me tell you quite clearly that honey's got no health advantages over natural sugar. It's the same. It's sweet. It's sticky. It rots your teeth, in other words. And contains about 80% sugar, just straight sugar. It's got 38% fructose, 31% glucose, and all sorts of other funny sugars like maltose. Now, I'm not going into reasons why, but maltose is not a good sugar. It's certainly not good for kids. It makes them very irritated and hyperactive. So the same applies, really, for odd things like, you know, bee pollen and royal jelly. It's really a bit of a hoax. I like, as a natural substance, I like to use maple syrup, so long as you use the real thing. For goodness sake, don't use the synthetic maple syrup. It's just sugar and chemicals and dyes that are made to taste like maple or somewhat like maple. It has to be the real maple syrup, which just runs out of a tree. It's just juice from a tree, the maple tree. But, of course, that's also just a lot of sugar, so you'd be best to do without it. What about stevia and Splenda and these other things? Again, I take the same position. It's best to try and retrain your palate rather than take these. Some of these are very sweet. You know, they're much sweeter than sugar. And if you take a tiny trace, you still get a huge blast. There's one called talin, T-A-L-I-N. That comes from berries grown on a West African plant. It's 2 or 3,000. 1,000 times sweeter than sugar. Well, why would you want that? You know, it's just going to make you crave sweet taste, and you're going to go crazy for sugary tastes and feelings. Wrong way to go, definitely the wrong way to go. But there are artificial substitutes called sugar alcohols. Now, you may have come across these. Sorbitol is one that we use for diabetics, for example. You can make diabetic-safe substances like that. Xylitol is a good one. Xylitol we use in my doctor's chocolate formula. Remember the doctor's chocolate I developed? I hope you've all had a try of that. If you haven't, you should go to the website. It's called drkeithschocolate.com. That's Keith's with an S, but there's no apostrophe. drkeithschocolate.com. Go take a look, because it's a very low-impact, low-allergy food. Xylitol is the sweetener. There's no sugar. Xylitol is good because it reduces cravings. It's an appetite suppressant. And people, I know people have lost a lot of weight, you know, 50, 60 pounds just eating, well, not just eating the chocolate, but by eating the chocolate and suppressing the appetite so they don't do all the wrong things. There are others that you'll find, like mannitol, and these turn up in so-called sugar-free candies and cookies and so on. Not as bad, but there are one or two liabilities even to those, you know. The FDA generally recognizes them as safe, but one of the most significant side effects, they cause diarrhea, which is unfortunate. I can't eat too much of my own chocolate because the xylitol has a strong effect on me, so I've got to be careful. That's a pity. And then finally, of course, well, I'm saying finally, I suppose I need to cover a few more things, but what about substitutes for rice, for example? In our house, we don't always use rice. We tend to avoid grains, but we're okay eating rice. Neither my wife or I are allergic to it. But a very good substitute you can make is taking cauliflower, take the heads, boil them well, and then mash them, just in exactly the same way you'd mash potato. This might be a shocking idea to some American housewives. I hope not. But you take one of those hand mashing tools and just go squish, squish on the cauliflower, and it will render down into a mush that's really almost indistinguishable from rice. I mean, it doesn't look as white, and it doesn't taste quite as sticky, but once you slap a nice chicken curry on it, you would hardly tell the difference, frankly. And, oh yes, chicken curry, perfectly okay. In fact, Indian food I recommend highly from the Indian subcontinent. It's generally whole food. You can generally trust it even in a restaurant. It's very fine whole foods. It's usually just vegetables and whole meat cuts, like whole chicken or whole beef or lamb, and then just mixed up with lots of herbs and spices. You can usually rely on that. If you make your own, you can definitely rely on it. So, you know, curry with rice, perfectly good meal for a person with allergies. Don't worry about the spices. You know, I hear this a lot from ignorant doctors. You know, you've got an ulcer. You mustn't eat spicy food. You mustn't eat salty food and so on. Nonsense. Your body's quite happy with chilies and hot spice. It's the dairy and the wheat and things like that it doesn't like. And in fact, if you let's say a person has a stomach ulcer or a peptic ulcer, get them off the wheat. It will often recover. I mean, there are other factors to bear, but very often a peptic ulcer recovered on this program. And the person could then eat all the spicy foods and hot coffee and things they wanted, and it didn't trouble their stomach at all. So it was only... It only affects a stomach that's already been irritated. So don't be afraid. Don't be afraid of spicy foods. Most spices are just herbs. They're just simple plants, you know, cumin and coriander and all these things. Very delicious. Okay, now another big issue is what do we do instead of bread? Bread is supposedly the staff of life. I think bread makes more people ill than any other food on earth. There's one of the important reasons it does that is modern bread isn't what it used to be. I'm not going into all the technical reasons, but the way bakeries now make it, the bulk manufacturing process makes it a very inferior product, and B, one that is much more likely to cause allergenic reactions. So we don't like bread. We would like to avoid it. There are two reasons for avoiding it. One is the wheat allergy. The other one is a yeast allergy. If you have a yeast problem, then you can probably make soda bread, which is rather like making a cake or muffins. You use baking soda to get the carbon dioxide gas and the bubble effect, so it fluffs up a little bit. It doesn't fluff up quite so much. But if you make it properly now, you know, I used to have an office in Dublin. I spent a lot of time there and used to have the most beautiful, delicious Irish soda breads. It really can be very gorgeous, even though it's not sort of real bread, as it were. But if your problem is the wheat, then you're stuck. You can't do soda bread with or without soda. You know, if the wheat is the issue, you've got to find some other substitute for that. And the trouble is, there really isn't one. You know, wheat is so famous and so valued and treasured as a food because it contains gluten, which is very sticky. When you see wet dough or a wet batter mix and you pull it out, it's very stringy, pulls into a long string. That's because of the gluten. Without the gluten, it wouldn't do that. And unfortunately, if you don't have the gluten and it's not sticky, then it just tends to turn to dust. So if you make, if you use substitute flours to make things like cookies and muffins, you've got that problem. It's often dry as dust, and when you bite into it, crumbs all over your lap. It can be a big problem. It's often easier just to not bother, frankly. Anyway, there are some ideas in the book which should get you started. There are lots of websites, I know, that cater to allergic people with alternative recipes, and there are even books on that. And my son has been kind enough to provide a list of menus. I wouldn't call them recipes. I mean, he's got recipes, but I told him don't bother with the recipes. Let people, you know, figure out the proportions that they like. But suggested kind of meals and menus that you can put together using all of these whole variety of things. And there's really quite a lot you can do with things these days. There are so many pleasing alternatives to what they used to be, where you would almost by choice, you know, go for the sort of allergy-safe substitute at least once in a while instead of the boring. I mean, to me, I can't think why people ever buy a McDonald's. It's so completely boring. It's the same fries taste, the same yellow color, the same pasty beef taste, same white bread with almost no flavor whatsoever, sugar on the fries. What's the point? You know, it's so repetitive eating foods like that. There's no variety in it whatsoever, and that doesn't compare at all with, you know, having a nice homemade fish taco one day and Indian type chicken curry say the next day, and then you know, your home cooked fish and fries that you make at home, which has got no colorings, no dyes, no sugar, no sweeteners, flavorings, nothing, just plain old potatoes sliced into fries and cooked in a good safe oil, and then bake your fish, which you can do with all kinds of herbs. I mean, a crusted cod steak you can have with herbs made up from all kinds of things like parsley and coriander and almonds. I mean, there's so many good things that you can do. To me, it's quite good fun in eating foods like this. I mean, sometimes we're busy and we eat out. You have to, you know, and especially if you're away from home, you're on a business meeting or whatever. But if you're at home, I really would like to encourage people to try and experiment more in cooking for themselves. Some of the meals are so simple, so easy to do. You have to say it's almost as easy and sometimes easier than the hassle of taking something out of a packet and microwaving it. I know that sounds absurdly silly and easy, but you know, sometimes it's a bigger hassle than they let on when you buy one of these packet things. And, of course, nowhere near as healthy. Anyway, okay, I've talked at length now about the subject of staying healthy, how to choose your food wisely. There's at least another 2 hours on this theme, but I won't give it to you now. What I'll do is open the lines for questions, and we'll talk about specific things that interest people. Take it from there. Okay, so if you're on the webcast, I can see a lot of you on the webcast, you're going to have to phone in if you've got questions. Oh, wait a minute, I've got my written questions, haven't I? So just give me a moment to trot through some written questions. Sherry, Staten Island. Yes, hi, Sherry. I've seen your name come up a couple of times. How long is it going on? She's really enjoying it, she says. I'm really pleased, Sherry. Next time we're going to cover other things, like things that are not allergy but have a bearing, like you know, parasites and enzyme digestive problems and so on. So at least one more, and I may go on four more. You know, I may run to 10. I'm certainly going to do at least 6. I may run it up to 10. And then somebody who's rather not say, has got a sore backside here. Conditions like diverticulosis, hemorrhoids, and hiatal hernia aren't caused by allergies and can't be corrected by this diet. Is this correct? No, rather not say. It is not correct. The number one cause of hemorrhoids is food allergy. Sounds absurd, but I promise you it's true. If you eat the right foods, you'll never see another hemorrhoid. If you eat the wrong, and the commonest thing, again, is wheat. You'd be astonished by the number of patients where they just couldn't believe it, but when they found it was true, that, you know, they ate the wrong foods on a challenge test, wham, back come the hemorrhoids. It was like, my God, I can't believe this. So that's good news for you, okay? That's not bad news. It's good news. It's saying it's treatable. If you find the food culprit, don't eat it. You need have no further trouble with hemorrhoids. Hiatus hernia, There's another story, hiatus hernia is a conventional diagnosis, and doctors are full of this amazing story. You know, it's your stomach rolls up into your chest. That's why it's called a hernia, and that causes irritation, yada, yada. I know the story. I've seen the x-rays. It's all totally boring. It's food. And I've never had a case with hiatus hernia. It's got a new fancy name now coming, but it's called regurgitation or whatever its current name is, fancy name. It's a food. And I've seen people avoid the food. It goes away. Had the repeat x-ray, it still rolls up in their chest, but they don't have any symptoms. So, the fact that this herniates or a stomach going into your chest is irrelevant, and it's not the cause of the symptoms like conventional doctors think. So there you are. If you've got either of those, or if you've got all three, diverticulitis, hemorrhoids, and hiatus hernia, I would encourage you, whoever you are, male or female, to get on the DietWise program forthwith. You'll find it'll be enormously helpful. Then you can come on to me or email with me and be a great testimonial, okay? Francie Prowse in Anza, who I know very well. I love this lady very much. When someone's losing weight, is there an emotional replay of old bad times correlating with the cells that are dying? Okay, well, I know what she's saying. Sometimes when you go into a healing program, you go through a recovery process that takes you back through old illness and you get die off and other things. Francie, the best I can say is you get lousy withdrawal symptoms sometimes, and you may address that or consider that to be the kind of thing that you're talking about. I wouldn't quite relate it exactly to what we know to be a healing crisis that we see in things like homeopathy, for example, where a person's disease rolls backwards. But certainly, dying parasites, do they emit a lament that can be mistaken for a mood in the body? Well, I don't know about worms screaming as they're dying, but worms certainly release a lot of toxins as they're dying. Dead bodies all over the place in your intestine. There can be a lot of toxins. You can feel really quite crummy when you go on a parasite cleanse. I'll address with you in private the idea of worms emitting a lament. She's very poetic and very lovely, fancy, and I know exactly what she's saying, an energetic ache, as it were, that's happening quite above and beyond the chemical, biochemical process I'm talking about. Randy, who lives in Troy, that's the Troy in Indiana, not the Troy in ancient Turkey. What's the story on protective energy products? Well, that's a different story, really, Randy. I'd rather not go into that. Sorry, I didn't realize that you were asking a question on that subject. Please email me. Go to the website and use one of the feedback forms, and I'll answer your question, but I don't think it's very relevant tonight. So I'm going to open the lines, okay, and let's get some live questions from live guests on the phone line. Okay, so anyone want to take a crack? Anyone there on the line with a verbal question, please?
Dr. Keith?
Yes, that's Victoria's voice. Hi, Victoria.
Old thing.
Go ahead.
I've been hearing a lot about a grain called salba lately. Do you know anything about that?
I don't. Spell it.
S as in Sam, A-L-B as in boy, A.
No, I don't know it. I'll Google it when we're finished. But there are a number of grain products. Remember, a grain's a grain. Okay, so if you've got a trouble with the grains and the grass family, it's not really going to be a substitute. And I can give you an illustration with a story of spelt. Now, spelt, biologically speaking, is an old-fashioned wheat. You know, it's a botanical sort of retard, as it were. And so a lot of people are selling spelt as a substitute for wheat because it's got the gluten. The trouble is, it's still wheat, you know, and people still react to it. So it can derail the whole process if you're not careful, picking up one of these alternatives that isn't really good. But the full answer is really, in respect of any food, you should always introduce it under careful trial conditions. If you've not eaten it before and you want to know if it's safe, follow the procedure that's given in the book for a food challenge test. Chapter 12, I think it is. Tells you, you know, in full detail what to do. If you follow that, it's unlikely you'll make a mistake. And if the stuff is okay for you, it's okay. But what I'm saying is, if you recognize it's already in a trouble family, I would say, why bother? Okay. What's actually on your mind, Victoria? What are you looking for? Something to make cookies from or what? Why do you think
it's just that the salba is being touted as a super health food and lowers blood pressure, and maybe it's not strictly a grain, but to me it sounded like it.
Yeah. Well, I mean...
It might be a seed like chia, similar to chia.
Well, look, I'm just taking a quick look online, because I'm not familiar with it, actually. I'm not a botanist, remember, a clinician. but it's being sold by one group here, for example, as a source of fiber and omega-3. So that suggests to me they're selling it as a whole grain product, not as a flour or farina-type substitute.
Mm-hmm.
I would say give it a shot. The only way for me to find out, if you give me a minute, is if I go and look at Wikipedia, if we just type in the word wiki, there'll be some very erudite article about the botany of salba. Actually, it's not appearing, so... Unless it's its name suggests that it might be in the salvia family. That's the thyme, the sage family.
Hmm.
So maybe it is. I'm not familiar with it anyway. So do your own research. And it's a cruciferous for a start. So there we are. It's in the mustard family. Okay. I've never heard of it and don't know what culinary uses it's got, but follow the same advice that I gave you for any food, really. Just try it. If you want to introduce it, try it. I know of no special qualities for it, and looking at it, it's not a grain. I know of no special reason to be suspicious of it. Should be okay, in other words, is the final answer after all the waffle.
Thank you. And will I get my book soon? I ordered it after Friday.
I sincerely hope so. I hope my wife who's listening will come in and enlighten me about that, and we'll give you an exact, direct answer. But I know a whole bunch went in the post yesterday, and another bunch went in the post today. So I would hope so, because you're in California. I hope you get it pretty quickly. If it's not with you in tomorrow's... Well, no, we better say Saturday's post, then give me a call. Huh?
Okay.
Let me know. Oh, sorry, an email. But you don't have my number yet. But I'll be speaking with you briefly on Sunday, I hope, anyway, so... I mean, with the brief interlude where you can raise that question again. All right, anyone else with a question?
One more from me.
Okay, go ahead.
Xylitol, I'm dealing with somebody who's extremely overweight, and would xylitol be a sweetener that we could use sparingly that wouldn't cause cravings?
Yes, it's an appetite suppressant, as I said. The one side effect that you might encounter is it causes diarrhea.
Okay.
Would this person like to eat chocolates? If so, send them over to get the doctor's chocolate. It's a function food. It's not a candy, remember. It is. It's got serious good pharmacological properties. It's a relaxant, kills the appetite. It's only 20 calories a piece, so a couple of pieces a day, which is the dose to give the...
If it tastes really good, it's not going to work for us.
Well, you think you'll eat them all? Well, I promise you, it's hard. No, really, people say that, but people find it very difficult to eat more than three or four. It kills your appetite. It really does kill your appetite. You when you get an ordinary bag of chocolate candies, you just have to eat the whole bag. Everybody knows that. But honestly, I swear to God, it's not true in this case that you can eat them two or three of them at the most, and you think, well, that's enough. You just don't want to eat more. So if it's for weight loss, there's some super stories if you go to that website, Dr. Keith's chocolate.com. And there's one I know still up there of a girl that lost 50 pounds, but she's got way beyond that now. That was many weeks ago that was put up. She's still losing steadily and doing great.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Try it. It could be a very happy solution to it. And you've also still got all your existing options if you don't like the chocolate when you've tried it.
Right.
Okay, anyone else? Any other questions, please? No? Okay. I think we're done. Anyway, I enjoyed it this week. And I look forward to seeing you next week, Sherry from Staten Island especially. It may be the last, but listen, Sherry, I'll think of something else anyway. But I'm glad you find it informative. What I'm going to do eventually is package this up as a bunch of CDs so you can play them in the car and listen to them again, things like that. But so for the next few days, you can come back or send anyone you want to this same web page, the same webcast page, and there will be a replay available, but that won't be edited. What I have to do is download it and edit it and then post it in the reading room elsewhere. And of course, as usual, I'll notify everybody when that's done. But that will be found at dietwisebook.com/readingroom. dietwisebook.com/readingroom. And you'll find the recordings of the previous ones there. All right, it's been great. Nice to talk to you all. And I'll talk to you again soon. Well, I'll talk to you again next week about this. But and many of you I know I shall see in the meantime. Especially look forward to next Wednesday night's teleseminar on the subject of the Rife machine. Okay, bye now.